let me jump right in. We're in Webster's. This is zoological record, and we're going to do a search for silk. So we get an abstract and a citation here, and there's this button down here that says Get at Cornell. So this presentation is about what happens when the patron clicks on that link. In this case, this is the display. They pull up the Get at Cornell page, and you see that the citation at the top, that's parsed out and displayed for the user as good as we can, as well as we can. And then the text, the links that are offered are the links that are appropriate for this particular title. So in this case, we found a full text link in Bio 1. It says article link. Our holdings for Bio 1 are January 2000 to the present. And then the patron is also offered links to the Cornell Library catalog in the interlibrary loan links. Now, when we implemented the new link resolver, WebBridge, our intention was to, when a full text link displays, only display the full text link. So in other words, the library catalog and interlibrary loan shouldn't be displayed here. But what we found is that the quality of the open URLs coming in is unreliable. And so we couldn't, in order to create the highest probability of the user actually getting to the resource, we've ended up putting them on there. So that's the other part of this talk is what's happening and why we should all care. So in this case, this is a beautiful example. It works as it should. It takes the user to the full text of the article, which is of course what they want. Back to our citation. So what happened here? Well, this is the link that is sent to the link resolver, but we'll clean it up a little bit. And we'll just spend a little bit of time walking through this. So up at the top where it says SID equals SPZOOR, that's Silver Platter Zoological Record. That tells the link resolver, it gives the link resolver some context of where it's coming from. It also gives us, we're able to record more exact statistics that way too. There's an ISSN. They've included an ISSN, volume 33, issue, start page, pages, date, and then journal title. Well, what's going on here with the journal title? I mean, this is the journal title. This is a space here, but it's represented in the encoding for the web. But this stuff here is extraneous. It shouldn't be there. Here's the article title. And then down here, we have author last name. They put a dash in there. Probably shouldn't be in there, really. And then there's a stuff called PID, which they just cram a bunch of stuff into. So this is the kind of thing that we get into the link resolver. So when people click on these things and they don't work, it's usually this kind of situation. So now, I mean, that's why I wanted to do this talk, is so that the people who are doing selection, making selection decisions and reference libraries and so forth, who are making the decisions about what we include, what we buy for our patrons, put this as a real high priority on the list of things that we consider when we're making decisions. So to go a little further, so what happened when we displayed that link? And now we'll dig into the link resolver a little bit. This is the administrative interface for the WebBridge link resolver. We're not going to go into all these different options here. The one that we're going to go into is edit resource definitions. So if we were actually in there and we clicked on it, we would see this list of resource definitions, and there's our link, Bio1 article link. That's the one that displayed to the user. So now we'll go in there, and these are the things that we, when we're setting these up for a given resource, this is what we do. We go in here. So we put it into a category, full text, for example. Here's what displays to the user, find at, and then whatever the name of the resource is, Bio1. And then this is important here, resolution server linking. What's that? Well, it's the syntax that we use to find the article, the full text article within Bio1. So one of the we have the proxy prefix here, and then we have, in this case, it's a proprietary syntax that we've derived from Bio1. And what we're doing is we're plugging in the ISSN, we're plugging in the volume, the issue, and the start page. And the other ones that tend to be important are date and title, journal title, depending on the resource. Now the other thing we do is we have to make sure that we actually have this resource. We don't want to display a link unless we have full text to it. And the way that we do that is we make some data tests. And the data tests are, in this case, we want to make sure it has an ISSN in the open URL because we've found that with Bio1 that's critical. We have to have that. So we test that. We won't display that full text link unless we have it. We match the date to make sure that we have it in our holdings, and then we match the title or the ISSN. And then the other thing that we do is we're actually matching against the Bio1 set of Bio1 holdings within the ERM system, which looks like this. So these are all in the ERM, IIIE ERM vocabulary. This is the coverage edit view, and these are all represented here on the left. These are all resources, so you can kind of tell what they are: Business Source, Premier, whatever you can. Cambridge. but here's our journal title right here, Journal of Arachnology, and there's the ISSN and so forth. Just to show, this is what's being checked. So each month we load in we load records into Voyager from Serial Solutions, and then we do an extract and we update the holdings within the ERM system. So this same database serves the find e-journals list and the link resolver.
So Adam, it's actually checking the coverage date against this to make sure that the article date is within the range?
That's right. So here's the start date right here, 2000. So the Open URL Resolver, is a core library service now. So far, and we're going to expand this, but we have these Gitit Cornell links in these different interfaces that we provide to our users, and with more to come as time allows. And by the way, if you're aware of some that you want us to add, let me know. because we can kind of prioritize these and start working on them. Usually it's very easy to go and either we contact somebody at the vendor site, or sometimes we can log in ourselves and add it. Camille, for example, had us add this connectee.org, and we just had to play around with it a little bit, and now there's a Get It Cornell link in there.
Adam, I think there are actually many more on this list
There might be.
It's good news.
That's good news, yeah. Now, in preparation for this talk, I went through the April statistics, and there were 28,000 clicks on these links in April, which, I mean, to me is just stunning. I mean, it's really popular when it works. And you can look at these links. You can there's this page that we've set up as a way to assess how well we're doing, and you can go there. If you have a particular resource that you like and you care about, you can go in there and yourself and check them and see how things are working out. You can go in, and if you break, you can take the open URL, put it in a text editor, and then break it down like I did. So each of those name value pairs is on a separate line, so you can read it. And then you can just go in and see what they're sending to us. And, you know, if they're sending us bad metadata, then we want to contact them and let them know that this is something we care about. That list looks like this. And so it's each day we have, yesterday's links. You can go in there and click on it to see what happens for the patron. And we could do that, you know, if we have extra time or something, we could go ahead and look at a few if you wanted to. But that's it, basically. That's what I wanted to say. I hope you're not disappointed. Phil?
So this idea of breaking down a target into all of its elements, is that sort of an interim solution until all publishers use DOIs, digital object identifiers? Because DOIs are pretty small and compact, and they identify a unique article. So in a way,
DOIs are better.
So this only works for those publishers and services that don't implement DOIs. Is that correct?
Well, so far we're not. Nobody's sending us DOIs. I think they're starting to. I'm starting to see some. What they'll do is they'll send a DOI plus the rest of the metadata. So when we'll kind of recalibrate, and when we find that pattern that they're sending us DOIs, then there's a DOI lookup in the link resolver that will take that, go out to Crossref, get back the associated metadata, check it against their holdings, and then display the link. So it does it takes care of this quality problem because you just have that number to deal with.
But the DOI would still be communicated via open URL. It's not as if DOI replaces open URL.
Right. It's an element within it.
So can you define unreliability or reliability? Do you have any when you were doing testing, do you have like percentages of known items that fail or whatever in terms of the...
I asked Michal, who works on this, he's maintaining this now, the other day, what his sense was, and I was afraid to ask. but I did anyway, and he's, because each day, he's working on this about 15 hours a week right now. And I've asked him to go in each day and go to this page and sample it, see how things are working. If he's finds a problem, record it into our system, and then resolve it, follow up on it, and see what's going on. His sense is that 60 to 65% of the links he's clicking on are taking patrons to full text, and they work. Our problem is the link resolver works great. The problems that we have are when we get bad metadata. Because the other situation is that we just don't have full text. and that link isn't displayed, and so the, you know, the library catalog link is displayed, and sometimes we have print holdings, or, you know, sometimes we don't have it at all. What we do know that people do click on the library links into the catalog, but they rarely click on interlibrary loan.
At some point, there was some discussion about not showing the interlibrary loan link, and that's part of the reliability problem.
Yeah,
that you show that even if you show the catalog as well.
Right, that was our real original intention with the full text linking, and I think we'll get there. I don't know how long it's going to take. I read an article in Harvard Business Review the other day about innovation ecosystem. And, you know, when these things come out, some players are further ahead with the technology than the ones that also need to be participating. And in this case, it's the A&I databases that are lagging behind. They have this tradition of these goofy different MLA format and, you know, all these different kind of things that they've been recording in their databases, but not parsing out as open URLs. So I've started this conversation with Jean Ford at Ovid, I guess is where she's at, Silver Platter, about this problem, and, you know, we're kind of starting a dialogue on it. But I'm not confident actually that they're really aware of how important this is to their business at this point. So again, that's what we can do.
So you were saying Harvard Business Review, that study, has there been a study almost of that accuracy where you've now identified Silver Platter has sloppy record URLs and open URLs, and, you know, so and so does a good job, so that they can see if there's people are starting to pay attention to it?
It could be done. I've thought about doing something like that myself. And actually, Oliver Pasha at EBSCO sent me, like, I don't know how many, 3 gigabytes of data or something, mm-hmm. as an email attachment. It's just so we, I mean, it, yeah. But, I mean, yeah, that might get their attention to do it that way. The other way is just to have conversations with them now in a friendly way. Leah?
How long, there's a lot of checking that runs each time there's a citation. It seems pretty fast. How long does it take?
When you click on that link?
Yeah, when you click on the Get It link.
There's a pause,
it seems,
and then it displays.
Good,
there's not a lot of processing that's happening. It's just, you know, it's...
The check, right?
Yeah, it has
the
to... It's parsing it out and so that you have a URL as a URL and putting it into memory and then checking that against the database.
If you did DOI, would that take longer since you're jumping out to the Crossref server?
I would expect so, okay. Yeah. By the way, we use Crossref a lot. What we do is because Crossref recently made the service available so that when we take those providers that have, are using Crossref, those content providers that use Crossref, there's a knowledge base within there that's associated with that DOI, and so we can send them a link that's pretty similar to this one to Crossref, and they'll resolve it and take us to the full text. Mm-hmm. And we have 15 different resources that we're doing that. It's great for us because it reduces our costs. We know there's one syntax for all these things, and we just set it up as Crossref. Crossref is fantastic, by the way. Yes, Fred.
In the case of vendors who do send this metadata that turns out to be quote banned, is that more the result of the fact that they're not following the standard in the way they're sending this formatting it, or is it more the fact that there might actually be just errors in the metadata, like wrong start page number?
No, it's that their formatting is bad. Yeah, I mean they're not keeping track of it in their own database in this way. I mean, they really should go through their whole database and say, okay, here's a citation, what is the best open URL for it, and then store that in the database and send that out to us. But they haven't invested in that yet, at Silver Platter anyway. I'll bet EBSCO has it, actually.
Is there at least a national standard or something that you can use as a model for that?
Yeah, it's the Open URL standard, ISO standard. Let me go to Keith and then Phil.
On the results page there, when you have multiple providers of the full text, are you displaying all of those, and are those sorted in any particular?
They are sorted. Yeah,
based on the reliability.
Yeah, we can give each of these. There's you see this says sort order, and this one says 10. 10 is a low number, which is good, meaning it's in this case it's an article link, and this is arbitrary. We've made up these categories ourselves. Something that is doesn't link well, like Factiva. or LexisNexis Academic Universe would be 100. In other words, we're going to display Bio 1 before we display Factiva to the user, because they are more likely to click on the first one.
And in the long run, that will affect the usage statistics for those individuals.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the other thing is, Phil, you have the next question, but download stats are certainly influenced by how this stuff all fits together. What was your question, by the way, Phil?
Variation within the publisher. So I'm thinking of not just the format, whether they're using MLA or APA format, but if some journals don't use issues, they just have page numbers. Some have, say, issue 3/4. Other things, does the inter-publisher variability have anything to do with the variability between articles, the fact that they don't all match the same? Does that have anything to do with the reliability issue that you mentioned earlier?
Well, before we display the link, we're testing on date and ISSN or title. So at that point, all we care about is the 4-digit date. Now, once we send it to the appropriate content provider for the full text, that's when it starts mattering. Because some of them, they're all different. They should just be accepting open URLs. They should just have an open URL interface, and then they can map it to whatever proprietary thing they have on their end. But they're not doing that yet.
So the open URL standard should take care of all those kind of issues that Phil mentioned?
You should be. I mean, if you're adhering to the standard, and you receive an open URL, you should be able to send the same open URL, just redirect it, and then the content provider should accept that, whatever it is, and then resolve it appropriately. But we're still in this early, believe it or not, it seems like this has been around for a long time, but it takes a long time for these companies to adjust. So?
I'm trying to remember, but when we were doing the testing, I think the other thing that really caused problems, and this is again another example of the failure to adhere to the standard, because the standard allows for it. But if you were in a database with mixed type of content, like articles and book chapters and conference proceedings and dissertations, most or many of the databases fail to identify what type it is, which also causes a lot of problems.
Yeah, the genre, on the incoming genre. That usually, it's not as big as a problem as some of the other things, but it is, it's also, people don't know which genre to use when they're putting it in the open URL.
Is there a reason why, if there's full text available, when they click the Get It button, they don't just get the actual PDF, like without the interim page?
It's up to the publisher, or the vendor. They, they could just take them directly to the PDF. They usually don't.
I think what Michael's asking is bypassing the WebBridge page, so it's not a publisher thing. I think it's our decision.
Oh,
yeah.
That's what we wanted to do. There's this feature in the software called direct linking. You see, direct connect resource.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we wanted to do. We wanted to click that on so that when the Bio1 link displays, they never see the Get It Cornell page. It just automatically takes them to Bio1, to that article.
Right.
But we found the quality of the links won't allow us to do that. We have to have kind of that setback position, so in case that link fails, they can go into the catalog or go into interlibrary loan.
Got it. Because the University of Rochester is doing something like that, where the patron clicks once and it
right.
goes all over the place to find it.
Well, I mean, we could do that, but we're handling it a different way. They're doing it only within their MetaSearch service within Encompass. Now, we could accomplish the same thing in a broader way with the link resolver if the open URLs were more reliable.
Do you do it as a publisher? Like, turn it on for Bio1, but not for
Bio2? Yeah, depending on, and by origin also. So if you know that we're getting good quality open URLs from a particular origin, and you know that ProQuest is good, but they tend to work well, we could set that one up. So we'll continue to monitor this and try to push that when we can. Linda?
Where would you put EBSCO on the scale of doing a good job?
They do a good job. I mean, I think they do a good job. I mean, I know they do because they've invested a lot in it.
A 10 or 100?
A 10.
It seems like publicizing those sorters would be incentive for
you know, it's interesting. I don't think it's, you know, the ANI, there's not an incentive for the ANI suppliers. I mean, the publishers want you to get to their full text, but it seems to me the ANI people just want to, you know, you're searching to find out what article you want to some extent. You know, I mean, it seems like there'd be a little bit less incentive for them to spend a lot of money on it unless there was a competing index.
Yeah, if there's a competing index and you're saying this is one of our critical points, right. Then if they're the only game.
If they're the only game in town.
Well, here's an example. Google Scholar is if you go, you know, back to your office and you look at that list, it's popular and it's very reliable. And now that's a little different situation. We actually make a file available of our e-journal holdings that Google harvests, and it's kind of funny. We actually have to break it into three different files because they can't handle one big file. but anyway, so they only display the Get at Cornell link within the Google Scholar interface when they've checked our holdings. So when they know that we already have full text. But from the user's perspective, this is kind of a tension between librarians and users. From their perspective, it just works better. You know, you click on it and that one always works. But from with Silver Platter, with some of these kind of legacy zoological record, these kinds of things that have old citations in them, where there might not be full text, it's less likely to be full text, let's say. We still need that stuff, and we still want to make a seamless transition for the user from that ANI interface to the actual item, however we do that, whether it's through interlibrary loan or through the catalog or whatever. So if they can raise their value and kind of preserve their place in the future, to me, if they do invest in this so that it preserves the value of that legacy metadata.
Do some of the archive products that we have, like JSTOR, work within the same principle? Is it really the producers? I'm sorry. Stop. I mean, I'm stopping the question. I'm not elaborating. you were talking about old legacy files like zoological record. Can we have, do our records from zoological, say for a JSTOR, allow us to link to archival titles that are not produced by the publisher, but by a third party that's with a moving wall?
Well, JSTOR for us is one of these targets, a resource. And so if we did get something, probably wouldn't be from Zoological Record, but someplace else, it kind of doesn't matter. It still works. If they have their stuff online and they're JSTOR is accepting these open URLs, doesn't matter what it is, it should just get you to the article. I'm not sure that answered your question, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
It did?
Yeah.
And JSTOR has been working pretty well, I think.
Yeah, JSTOR works pretty well. Oh, okay.
Thank you.